You're listening to The Write Process, a podcast in which one writer tells the story of completing one work from concept to completion. I'm your host, Charlie Jensen.
Hi, my name is Tamika Thompson. I am the author of the short story collection, Unshod, Cackling, and Naked.
Tamika Thompson is a writer, producer, and journalist. She's the author of the speculative fiction collection, Unshod, Cackling, and Naked, which Publishers Weekly calls powerful, unsettling, and terrifying, as well as author of the horror novella, Salamander Justice. Her work has appeared in several speculative fiction anthologies, as well as in Interzone, Prairie Schooner, The New York Times, and Los Angeles Review of Books, among others. She has producing credits at Clear Channel Media and Entertainment, as well as at NBC and ABC News. She received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from Columbia University and a Master of Arts in Journalism from the University of Southern California. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. A beauty pageant veteran appeases her mother by competing for one final crown, only to find herself trapped in a hand-sewn gown that cuts into her flesh. A journalist falls deeply in love with a mysterious woman, but discovers his beloved can vanish and reappear hours later in the same spot, as if no time has passed at all. A cash-strapped college student agrees to work in a shop window as a mannequin, but quickly learns she's not free to break her pose. Entering worlds both strange and quotidian, and spanning horror landscapes both speculative and real, Unshod, Cackling, and Naked asks who among us is worthy of love and who deserves to die.
There really were two starting points to this collection. The first starting point, I would say, was when I began my writing career. I had come from a background in journalism. I took a short story class with Stephen Cooper at the Writers Program. And the first story in this collection, The Bats, I actually workshopped in Stephen's class. And it was a very early version of this story. And you keep in mind, this is like a decade ago. And luckily, Stephen was there to say, Tamika, the short story form is very specific to one character, typically. And you want to talk about a story in which that character is experiencing something for the first time, something for the last time, or something for the time that is different. And this really stuck with me. And I don't think that this collection would exist if I hadn't had that moment back then. I was off after that. You know, I was writing short stories. I was sending them off to anthologies and to literary journals, to magazines that were speculative. And I remember when that story, The Bats, actually got published, I went back to Stephen and sent him an email and said, I did it! It's not a major publication, but it's out in the world. And I think that that was really the beginning, not only of my writing career and my writing practice, but that was the true beginning of the collection without me even knowing it at the time. Fast forward to late 2021, I was approached by an editor that I had met through publishing short stories. And this editor said, I am looking for book-length fiction. I didn't have book-length fiction at that time. I went back and took a look at all of my stories. And I started to ask myself, is there a common thread in these stories? Are any of these stories in conversation with one another? Is there something that I am trying to say or that the stories are trying to say that are coming up in each and every one of them? So in late 2021, I began working on the collection as a collection, putting together the table of contents, putting together the stories that would go in it, understanding the themes, and really writing the pitch for it. The pitch was such an important part because, unlike a novel, I'm working on something that has to be brought together, and I have to understand the themes that are flowing through it. I'd say that process took a few months of figuring out which stories to include and what that pitch was going to be. I looked at similar titles during that time. I looked at two horror story collections that were written by Black women, considering the idea that their readers might be interested in this collection and that that would be a way for me to pitch it. And what I came up with was that the stories were examples of transgressive fiction. I noticed right away that two stories, Mannequin Model, which is the title story because Unshod, Cackling, and Naked is the final line of Mannequin Model, and Under the Crown, were in conversation with each other because they both have young Black women who have been forced to be something they don't want to be. Really dealing with, in some cases, abuse, in some cases, oppression, in some cases, societal expectations. And there's a little bit of those three horrific things happening to each of these women. But they each make a decision of how they are going to deal with those forces with varying outcomes. In I Am Goddess, she chooses a very violent path and continues down that. In Mannequin Model, it is a decision that she makes that is violent, but is not as destructive. I think in Under the Crown, that character really struck the right balance. She chooses a path that is different than what she is on. She upends everyone's expectations of what a beauty queen is supposed to be. She gets the other women who are on the stage competing in this pageant excited for the idea of freedom. But no one gets hurt physically. No one gets hurt physically. I think if you take these three women and you look at what's been happening to them and you look at the choices that they make, these are in conversation because the reader would then reflect upon what society has done to these women and what these women have done with that. And which of these, I wouldn't say is right or good, but which of these choices is the most effective? I have my thoughts, obviously. Those were some of the things that I noticed when I started to go through and look at these. Which stories were saying something to the others in the collection? I saw these things and said, well, you know what? I think I do. I think I do have a collection here. Once I figured that out, I put together the table of contents and I sent it to that editor. He was excited. I was excited. The problem came into play when we sat down to discuss business and we could not agree on a contract. And that's the reality. That can happen, right? That's something that does happen. We walked away from it, but I believe that everything happens for a reason, because if he had never approached me, I would not have put together the collection. I put it on submission to other places. I started shopping it around. And so much of the submission process for me is really not about sending it out. It's about researching the presses, researching the publishers at those presses, their personalities, reading their interviews, understanding whether or not that press is going to be excited about the work, going to be a partner and willing to work alongside me, and I can work alongside them in marketing the work. And so that submission process took probably another 6 or 7 months. One of the places that I sent it to was Unnerving Books, which is a Canadian small horror press run by an editor named Eddie Generous. And I had read some of the other writers that he had published who went on to have great careers within the horror world. Eddie is a writer himself. And I got the sense that he would be willing to partner with me, and that if he sent me a contract, it would probably be a contract that I would be okay with, because he had been on the other side of it and he understood it. And that ended up being the case. In July of 2022, that was when Eddie and I began working together. Even once we signed a contract, between the time of submission and the time of the contract, I had written another story. And I didn't think that that story that I had written was necessarily going in the collection. But when we went back and looked at the table of contents, I saw that that story actually thematically does fit in with the collection. So I took it to him and said, hey, I have another story. What do you think of this? And he said, this is great. Do you want 14 stories? And I told him that I would like to trade out. And that was Abduction Near Knife Lake, which is the final story in the collection. The inspiration that I have for most of the stories that I wrote for this collection, I would describe as seeds. There is going to be a seed for every story. And this is just how my brain works and how I operate on a day-to-day basis. I will see something, I will hear something, I will experience something, I will read something. And that seed will be planted in my mind. And I am unable to stop thinking about it until I put it on the page. For the story of the bats, the seed was an actual bat that landed on the screen of my mother's apartment during the middle of the day. And that is an example of a sick bat, because bats are not supposed to be out in the middle of the day. That seed stuck with me and eventually became a story idea. And so when I get these little seeds, when I'm throughout my day, I will usually open up a document on my phone and just put that seed in there. Sometimes it is so strong, the image is so strong, or the idea is so strong, that I have to get back to it and work on it immediately, like within that day or within that week. So that's how I would answer the question of inspiration. It's usually going to be a happening. Something has happened and I've experienced it. I am not the type of person who can sit down and just let the universe come through me onto the page. And it's just going to be, I have to set aside, today I'm going to be working on this story. I'm either going to be drafting or I'm going to be revising. And I'm going to do it at this time. For me, that's in my office at home. It could be 6 a.m. before I get the kids up, and I'm just sitting in bed, and I'm marking up a copy of my manuscript that I've printed out. I'm going to find the time. Sometimes that flows and sometimes it doesn't. And on the days that it doesn't flow as much as it does the others, I'm still putting in that writing time. I cannot wait for inspiration. I cannot wait to be in the mood. I cannot wait for everything to line up, because that will never happen. I have to have that force within me to sit down and do these things and make sure that I complete my manuscripts and that I get them into the world, because my job is to persevere. I believe that the job of the writer is to persevere. Their job is to persevere to complete their manuscript. Their job is to persevere to get it out into the world. In order for you to do that, you have to set aside physical, emotional, and mental space. And it could be a dining room table. It could be the counter in the kitchen. It could be a corner in your bedroom. And sometimes it's not going to always be quiet. The thing that has worked for me is to make sure that every day when I write, I know what time I am going to do that writing, and I know what I'm going to be working on. As far as my day-to-day writing process, it really depends on my children's schedule. I operate around whatever it is they have going on. Before the pandemic, I had set times that I would work on my writing. During the pandemic, that all became upended. We're an African-American family. We were really just trying to survive. I actually lost my grandmother to COVID. I did not have a lot of the physical and emotional space to really sit down on a schedule. And so for 2 years, I didn't submit anything. I was taking all of these story ideas and placing them in documents, but I did not have the physical space to sit down. And even if I wrote something, I didn't have the space to submit it. But in 2022, I made up my mind that I was going to submit. I was going to send things out no matter what. And I really was able to get back to my writing practice. I believe it is so important for writers to make a decision to be a professional writer and to create a writing practice for themselves. And the process of creating a writing practice is to create a physical space for yourself and to create time that you are going to work on your craft, but really to guard the time. I think that that's the step that is missing for a lot of people who are not able to complete works. They will create the space and the time, but then they won't guard it. And so I guard that time by saying, mommy's writing. Sometimes you put a sign on the door, right? You tell your spouse, you tell your mom, you tell whoever is making demands of your time, you have to let them know this time is protected. I will need to do this. When my kids are not at school, if it's summertime, if I don't have enough childcare, it's really going to be first thing in the morning before the day begins, last thing at night once everyone is in the bed, typing on my phone when I'm waiting in line, trying to grab those moments. But it has to be purposeful. I have to know each day when I am going to do that, even if it's not at the same time each day. And it really hasn't been for the last 6 months. It really has been, tomorrow I'm going to write at 7 a.m. You know, Friday, it's going to be noon, you know. But everyone knows when I say that I am working on something that they really need to step aside, because I am going to be protecting that time. But I think generally for me, the writing process is really in probably about five categories. The first category for me is drafting, is the fun part, the writing to, I need to get a complete first draft. That's usually going to be the shortest time. I try to do that as quickly as possible, within a week, within 2 weeks. And then I put it away for a little bit. And I might put that away for another 2 weeks or so. But when I come back to it, I have taken off that writing hat and I'm putting on my revision hat. And I believe that revision is where writers earn their readers. Revision is where you are taking everything that's inside of you. And that's what I do. I take everything that is inside of me from the time I wrote it until that moment of revision, and I put it into the story. Every horror movie that I've seen, every horror book that I have read by another author, every experience that has happened, I take that along with the skills that I've gotten from the writer's program or from other workshops that I've done, and I try to take those and put those into the work. But at the same time, I am looking at it and figuring out, what is the text trying to say? What is the story trying to say? What is the aboutness of this story? And it could be something that you just want someone to consider. But it's my job, I feel, to know that in the revision. I will put that away and come back to it and put it away and come back to it. I will print off revisions and go in and mark it up with a pen or a pencil. I'll send it off to someone to read. And I'm usually pretty careful about that, because not everyone that I know has the same taste that I do. But I usually send it off to some other writer to read it and to give me their thoughts. I continue on the revision process for a really long time. It could be a number of years, even on a short story, because it may take that. For the story, I Am Goddess, it began as a flash fiction story. I started it as a very small snippet of a woman who wanted to get treatment to be more beautiful for her husband. I realized pretty early on that this was not going to work as a flash fiction story, that Lyra, the character, had more to say. And so the first draft of this story as a short story, she was going through the motions of talking to her husband about why these treatments were important. And she had gone out of her way to make this, you know, wonderful dinner and to have everything be so perfect for him. But the true story of Lyra was still missing. I wasn't ready to send it out. I kept coming back to it and saying, I'm never going to send this story out until I have this piece of it figured out. It registered with me that this was Lyra's origin story. It did not begin at the moment that she wanted the treatment. It began when she was a little girl and was being given clues about whether or not she was of value. And she learned very early on that she was not of value because she didn't look the way that society thought a beautiful girl or woman should look. And so all of her value then had to become being of service to someone. Once I had that, then I realized that I had the story. I still wasn't happy with the draft. I didn't have in the earlier version where she was going. I sort of stopped at the moment that she erupted, but it didn't have in it where Lyra was headed. And this is essentially a slasher story. It ended up in a publication that was a very violent horror publication. Many of the stories in there are extreme horror. And Lyra was acting against her husband, but she was also acting against society. She was acting against every awful thing that everyone had ever said to her, from her parents to her cousin to the women in the church. She wanted revenge against all of these people who had hurt her, classmates, and she went to great lengths to get that revenge. And I had it, and I still wasn't happy with it, because I wanted it to matter in the life of this character. And how it mattered in the life of the character is because it led to that thing that Stephen Cooper told me all those years ago in short story class. This was the time that was going to be the first, the last, or something different. This was the first time that Lyra killed someone. And the idea that this character could go from doting wife, meek, wanting to please people, being a people pleaser, to this very villainous murderer who actually is excited by the idea of blood being on her, that this could be this character's reaction to everything that had been done to her. When I had that, then I realized that I had the story in the form that I wanted it to be. That's why I say it can take years, because, you know, you have it and you go back and you look at it and it's like, ah, this still isn't right. You know, let me go back and look at this again. And I kept doing that and kept doing it. And I didn't want it to be a novelette, right? I didn't want it to be a novella. I wanted it to be in a form that would get published in a horror anthology. I sent it to Sinister Smile Press, and they're the only press that I sent it to, and they took it right away. And here's the thing. When it made it into the anthology, the story itself actually got reviews, positive reviews within the anthology, which I had never experienced before. This was the first time that my work had been reviewed as an individual story within an anthology. I was really pleased because I felt that somebody got what I was trying to do, that it took me all those years to put together. The next step is submission, researching what is going to be a good home for it, getting it out there, dealing with the rejection, making more revisions. Sometimes I have to back up to the revision step after getting some feedback, if you're lucky enough to get feedback. And then the publication and contract and working with the editor process on each of these stories, but then also on the big picture. And that's going to be making sure I get those copy edits back to them, making sure that I get the proofs back to them after we do the proofreading, making sure that we agree on everything, and then moving into marketing. So when I submit work, and in the case with this collection, when I submitted it, I put it out of my mind. I put the entire thread of the collection out of my mind because I cannot focus on new work if I'm thinking about work that is on submission. And so that's what I did with Unshod, Cackling, and Naked. I sent it off for submission and then I forgot about it. In that time, while it was on submission, I worked on a new story, Abduction Near Knife Lake. And the seed for that story is the idea that certain people within our society are not as valuable as others. I think the story arrived within me at the time that it did because there were a number of national news stories about young women who had gone missing. And there was a national conversation at the time about the fact that Black girls specifically do not make headlines when they go missing. I think that even though I put submissions out of my mind, the through line of Unshod, Cackling, and Naked, the themes were still within me subconsciously. And I think I wrote this without really knowing that I was writing it as the final story to this collection. And so there is a bit of otherworldliness, I think. There is that part of the writing process that kind of floating down to us from the ether. And I think that this was one of those instances. It just fit perfectly once I went back and took a look at the collection. I think the fun thing about working on a story collection is that when the editor or publisher gets back in touch with you, they're pretty sold on the stories because the majority of the stories have already been published. Eddie and I worked on the table of contents, making sure that we had the right stories in. And once we had that table of contents, we moved right into copy editing. There were no editorial changes to any of the stories. It was really copy editing and proofreading. I began working with what he wanted for the cover. And Eddie created the cover himself. I was not expecting that. I knew Eddie was a writer and I knew that he had the press and he had the magazine, but I was not expecting for him to also do the cover. And I was really happy with it. He understood the stories and he understood why Unshod, Cackling, and Naked was the title of the collection. And he really ran with it, I think, and put together a cover that is provocative, that matches the title. And very subtly lets the reader know that there is something dark or sinister on her feet as she is walking over cut glass. I knew when I saw the cover that he really got the collection. He really understood what I was trying to do. I think having that very early on in the process made working with him very easy. A short story collection coming from a Black author who is not known in the horror world, but then being picked up by Publishers Weekly Booklist was a pretty big deal for us anyway. It's not the typical response when you haven't already made a name for yourself, that people were aware that it was out there, making connections with other writers who had similar projects, other writers within the horror world, so they could just know about the collection. And I think that that was why we were really able to have a little bit of buzz when the book came out. Once I get to the point where the story is out there, I have to do some work in promoting it on social media, doing readings, making sure that I'm talking about the work, that I'm letting people know where to purchase it. And so it can be exhausting because you have so many steps that you need to go through in order to have a work make it into the world. But look at how wonderful this job is that we get to do. I won't complain. I think the final thought, when I was growing up, my mother put me in modeling, acting, pageants, TV commercials. I always had an agent and I was doing all these things from a very young age, from the age of 4. And I think that that set me up for the idea that you cannot take rejection personally, that rejection is redirection. You have to be able to persevere in the face of rejection. I mean, it's constant rejection. And I think you are always on a path to something, right? And so your job is really to not let the rejection stop you from what it is that you want to do. The only way that you're going to be able to get your work out into the world is if you take that rejection in stride.
And now, a reading from Unshod, Cackling, and Naked.
The parking lot at the assisted living home where I organized activities and coordinated mealtimes for seniors became littered with missing dog flyers, some large, others small, and with varying display techniques. Entire windows were plastered with the signs. Some light poles held up flyers of 4 or 5 family dogs, poodle, Pomeranian, Pekingese, and pug. No one knew where they'd gone, but the nights were filled with distant howls that lasted for hours. It was as if there was a dog convention out yonder and humans couldn't find it. The dogs who remained with their owners grew isolated and antisocial. Folks who were used to their pooch climbing in bed with them noticed their dog would find a corner in a room all to itself and sleep there instead. Their pets no longer rose and greeted them at the door when they entered. The dogs were fine physically, eating heartily, with regular digestive systems, ran when they were outside, and interacted with one another as usual, playing, cuddling, fighting to maintain rank. They just seemed uninterested in the humans who filled their lives. A black and rust Doberman Pinscher showed up on my porch one morning and stared at me through the picture window. Eating a banana nut muffin and sipping coffee in my kitchen, I felt the dog's gaze on me before I noticed it was there. And when we locked eyes, I dropped the muffin and the mug. The shards scattered across the tile. One swiped my ankle and drew blood. When I searched the window again, the Doberman was gone. A month later, I saw a news article about dogs dying from an odd illness in which they no longer rose to eat and play each day until eventually they just stopped breathing. Vets performed autopsies and sent samples to labs, and that's how the microbe was discovered. Social media was filled with teary-eyed owners posting about their dead fur babies. Some folks held doggy funerals, and others decided to make video tributes to their pups ahead of their demise. The dogs that had run away all seemed fine. Micah and I joked that the dogs had probably developed an allergy to humans. The night howling grew in volume and sounded closer than what I remembered in the beginning. Then one evening, the residents at my job were having the cutest dog contest in which they dressed up their pets in doggy gowns and tiaras and made them model down the dog run for bone-shaped biscuits. Though I'd been asked, I refused to judge the pageant and had to restrain myself from stripping off the dog's garments, opening the iron entry gates, and setting them loose. As I cleared up morsels of beef treats, ruffled puppy boas, and squeaky rubber ball toys from the activity lab, Mrs. Petrosky nodded off in the corner, but woke when she heard the distant animal calls. She rose from the rocking chair with creaking bones and an unsteady gait and attempted to hurry down the hall to her apartment. "Everything okay, Mrs. Petrosky?" I followed her. It wasn't like her to move about so quickly, and this was the most I'd seen her without her cane in the 4 years I'd worked at New Adventures Assisted Living. "He'll scratch a hole in the wood if I don't let him out." She unlocked her apartment, and her golden retriever Henry leapt out of the front door, throwing the woman off balance and knocking her to the ground. Henry dashed down the hallway, and when he came to the glass double doors that led to the parking lot, he raised on his hind legs and used his front paws to push the metal bar to open them. I rushed to Mrs. Petrosky, who'd landed on her bottom hard enough to dislodge her dentures and send her wig flying to the carpet. I helped her up and into her unit. Luckily, she was uninjured, but her hands trembled. "Whenever he hears the others, he goes crazy. It's not like he's never heard howls before, but with this, it's like they're calling him." "Who?" "The pack." "Does he usually come right back?" I eased her onto the couch and grabbed her a glass of water. She shook her head. "Get two glasses." She wrung her hands as I poured shots for both of us. "Since it all started, every night, Henry raises his head at the sound, stares at the window, and then, instead of howling back like a sensible mutt, he scratches at the door until I wake up and let him out. Then, hours later, as I get myself to the bathroom for my nighttime routine, get the linens ready, and I'm just about to climb in bed, he's back, scratching at the door. What do you think he does out there?" "I don't know, but one time he returned with blood on him. I searched his fur from head to toe, but didn't find any cuts." "Isn't this all so strange, dear?" Henry did not come back that evening. 2 days later, the turn occurred.
The Right Process is hosted and curated by me, Charlie Jensen. This season was produced by Jamie Moss. The Writers Program offers courses, certificates, and services that help writers achieve their writing goals one page at a time. For more information, visit writers.uclaextension.edu.